This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
...to WBAI in the previous epoch of our ghastly need. Make good on it. Send the money in, because after all, we're sending the radio out to you. And, you know, quid pro, you know. This is Radio Unnameable. My name is Bob Fass. That's Bill Propp over there, writing down the telephone number of Paul Krasner, who we will be calling in a moment or two. And we'll have a little bit of a conversation before too long. Like I say, thank you very much for your support during the little fun drive that we had. Now, it is not the most successful fun drive in the history of Pacifica, nor is it the least successful. It is a step up from what we've been doing, and I hope we can continue to encourage you to, you know, do the right thing, okay? You know, this was your theme song for years when you did a radio program.
Rolling Stone. That was decades ago. Holy moly. I try to stop chronology, but I can't.
Well, I'm going to get right to the... You sent me a link to... film, a video, a documentary. You know what I'm talking about?
About hemp oil for disease?
Hemp oil is a cure for cancer.
That's what the message is.
Well, I didn't see it. My computer is very slow, and it sort of stuttered, and I didn't watch it. But could you talk about it a little bit?
Well, it's this fellow, Rick Simpson, in Canada, has done his own personal research and talks about how hemp oil has cured cancer, and there are several people in this documentary who it almost seems like an infomercial talking about the how they were cured of cancer. But you know, it's a and in one of the things, it's a little bit bizarre because it was almost like a Saturday Night Live image, because he was showing you how to extract this from the marijuana plant.
You said it's very dangerous.
Yeah, to try and do it yourself like he was doing, because if there's any spark at all, it could blow up the place. Please do not try this in your garage.
But is there likely to be a clinical trial?
It's doubtful at this point because there's so much prejudice against alternative methods, even though they make the point in this documentary that that more people die from chemotherapy than are cured by it. So it's like any tradition. It's like it's not in the mainstream culture that you would stomp on some marijuana plants, get the oil in a certain way and add these ingredients to get this stuff that, you know, can be applied internally or externally. And so I'm just telling you what the essence of this documentary was. I can give you the name and people can Google it for themselves, I guess.
Well,
it's an hour long.
Well, I'm going to try to download it on a better computer.
Okay.
But you've seen it.
Yes.
And there are always there isn't a health program on the air that doesn't have some kind of an anecdotal report of somebody who cured themselves of kidney stones by, say, using oregano oil or vitamin something or other. But these anecdotes aren't always that convincing.
I don't think they were actors who were telling how they were diagnosed and how they were cured.
Well, were they deluded people, or were they?
I didn't get them. I'm a professional skeptic, but it seemed genuine to me. Didn't seem they had any motivation other than to share what they considered miraculous. You know, and it can be applied externally.
Mm.
Now, obviously, I'm not a doctor. I don't even play myself on television.
That's true. But you have had a lot of experience with hemp oil.
I've had more experience with phonies, and these people didn't seem to be. No, I had hash oil, not hemp oil. It's different. It's a totally different process. But there was an article in High Times a few months ago, a long article by Steve Hager about this, and. I think there should be, testing, clinical testing. I'm sure they would have plenty of people who,
would volunteer to.
Yeah, absolutely. So, that's even what, I never thought that in the same paragraph I would mention hemp oil and the 9/11 truth movement. But I think, you know, they should have, I don't agree with their conclusions, but I think that they should have, there's no such thing as a clinical trial, but,
they should have some sort of a trial.
Well, you know, they believe what they're saying, for better or worse. So, anyway, you've heard the latest news, by the way, that the Toyota Corporation has merged with McDonald's, so now that they can use the same slogan, "You deserve a break today." Ta-da, ta-da.
Unintended calories.
Unintentional calories, yes.
Well, I don't want to drop that subject, Paul. I want to return to the thrilling days of yesteryear when you said it was hash oil, but Linkin Park honey, which you and I both had, I don't know whether I had my fill of it, but I had quite a bit of it at one time, so much of it that I was thoroughly incapacitated. And I don't remember any reports of people who had Linkin Park honey being stricken with the big C. Maybe it does work.
Well, that's one way to do it.
Linkin Park honey was made, I believe, with hemp oil. Hash oil was a later modification.
Well, as we speak, I'm booting up... you know, my autobiography was published in 1993 by Simon & Schuster.
There's going to be a new edition of it?
Yeah, and expanded about 50 more pages. And if I can ask Nancy in the next room to please bring me a little water.
Hi, Nancy.
Bob, Nancy says hello.
Hi, Nancy. Great
anyway,
pictures, Nancy.
Oh yeah, no. She takes a photo a day, and then captions come from all over. Anyway, I'll read this little section from the book, which is titled "Confessions of a Raving Unconfined Nut: Misadventures in the Counterculture." And it should be launched maybe even this month. So let me just find that section here. Oops. Tell me something that's going on the East Coast while I get this on my computer screen. Something must be going on there.
Well, I can play some more of the...
No, it'll only take me a second. Okay.
Can't you see him hurriedly turning through the pages, looking for the places that he had bent down with a kind of a dog ear on the top of the page? And, oh, no, is this the, that's the spot. Is that it? No. Did you find it?
Yes, yes. Tell me when.
Now.
Okay. Now, I just have to get the setting. This was it comes out in the thing. Okay. The mad scientist was neither mad nor scientific. Actually, he had been active in theater. However, when he took LSD for the first time in the lighting booth, where he watched a production of Cyrano he had directed, he decided to leave the theater for the streets. In May 1968, he was in Paris with a suitcase full of hashish. He had been tangentially political before, but But now he found himself in the middle of a citizens' revolt. Barricades were being erected with the same cobblestones that had been dug up in the original French Revolution. The physical experience of being there served to radicalize him. None of his friends was a chemist, but somehow they had learned to make hash oil. Meanwhile, he was feeling a cultural force from America. The Yippie myth had crossed the Atlantic, and he decided to go to Chicago. On the weekend before the convention, the mad scientist went strolling through Lincoln Park, asking, "Do you know Abbie Hoffman?" Eventually, he asked Abbie himself, and before you could say hidden laboratory, there was one. The lab consisted of long tables spread out with hundreds of packages of Bugler tobacco. The hash oil was cut with pure grain alcohol, put in atomizers, and sprayed on a tobacco, which was then placed in the packages and given away as Yippie cigarettes. For those who preferred a healthier version, the hash oil was mixed into jars of honey. This was strong stuff. The fugs were completely fugged up. Ed Sanders described the grass he was walking on as, quote, "a giant frothing trough of mutant spinach egg noodles." Thule Kupferberg took a taste, and friends had to carry him back by the armpits, back to the apartment where he was staying. "They're delivering me," he explained. I swallowed 2 tablespoons of honey and stayed in the park. I was on my knees, holding on to the grass very tightly so that I wouldn't fall up. The Yippie leaders were all zonked out of their minds. A group of us were driving around Chicago when we realized that we were being followed by another car. It was like being in a slow-motion chase scene. But could this merely be paranoia as a side effect of the hash oil? I suggested that we go the wrong way down a one-way street. Then if the other car was still following us, we could be sure that they were following us. We stopped in front of a guy sitting on a bench. I got out and told him that we thought we were being followed. We would drive around the block, and if he saw that this other car was in fact following us, he should give us a signal. So we circled the block, the other car followed us, the guy on the bench gave a signal, and we continued on, figuring that now the two men who were tailing us had to wonder what this guy had just accomplished that he was signaling us about, and should they maybe follow him instead. The previous day, we were refused service at a restaurant. I told the manager, "You're about to have your first Yippie sit-in," and they finally served us. Now, we stopped there again, shook hands with the manager, and told him there were no hard feelings, even as he was being put on the suspect list by the cops who were following us. We also stopped at an art supply store where we had been treated rather rudely, and we got them listed as accomplices, too. Finally, we parked. So did the cops. We got out and walked back to their car. They tried to appear nonchalant. "Hey," Abbie asked, are you guys following us?" "That's right." "Are you federal or local?" "We're plainclothes officers with the Chicago Police Department. You're under 24-hour surveillance." "Wow, 3 shifts just for us." "No, we're short on manpower. We're on 2 12-hour shifts." "Well," I said, "it's an honor just to be nominated." We introduced ourselves and shook hands with the cops. Their names were Herbie and Mac. We offered them official Yippie buttons, the Yippie label buttons, but they said, "No thanks, we're on duty." I explained that if we happened to lose them in a crowd, we'd be able to spot them more easily if they were wearing Yippie buttons. So they accepted the buttons and planted and pinned them on their jackets. But this kind of communication is a two-way street. And now the cops asked us if we were planning to eat soon because they had been following us for a while, and now they were getting sort of hungry. Although we had terminal dry mouth from the hash oil, maybe lunch would stimulate our salivary glands. We asked the cops to recommend a good restaurant since we were new in Chicago. "Well," Herbie said, "the Pickle Barrel at Old Town has pretty good food." And, Mac added, "their prices are quite reasonable." "Okay, what's the best way to get there?" "Follow us." This was indeed a rare and precious moment. We obediently got back into our cars and followed the cops. I thought they were going to try and shake us, but we managed never to lose sight of them. It was as if someone had pushed the rewind button, and now our slow-motion chase scene seemed to be running backward. I expected to see the cops stop at the art supply store, and then the restaurant, and then a guy sitting on a bench would give them a signal. But instead, we just followed them straight to the pickle barrel. We sat at separate tables. And I'll tell you, that hash oil gave us a big appetite. So, that, and I didn't read the part where there was supposed to be a concert with the
MC5.
The MC5, the Motor City
right.
5 from Detroit.
I was supposed to be the MC.
You were the MC, and you were just standing there with a smile on your face.
Unable to speak.
Unable to speak, but the entire audience had also had some hash oil, and they were unable to listen. So it was a perfect mesh.
They understood.
They understood. They identified totally with you. It, you know, empathy like that should be taught in school, starting in kindergarten. So anyway, yeah, that did bring back a memory. But that was hash oil. And what I was talking about before was hemp oil.
Well, we're going to have to get hold of that DVD. And I don't know, maybe... I wonder if it's possible to use it as a premium without endorsing it.
Well, I can put you in touch with the person who sent it to me.
Okay. All right. All right. Who was it? You said that there's a website. Maybe people can look at it now.
Oh, the website. Let's see.
Well, if you can't find it, I can find it probably in the email you sent me.
Oh, that's right. Oh, I'll look under my sent emails. Very good. I knew it would be somewhere. Okay. This is still just all actually electronic magic to me as I'm clicking on this. It all is. You know, a GPS, I think I'm dreaming. I mean, there are kids being little kids today. People just kids just coming into the world who have a whole different awareness. You know, they take Google for granted, and I still think it's a pact with the devil. So okay, let's see here. Remember the subject line? Oh, I see. Okay, here it is. Here it is. The subject line is hour-long documentary. And you will find it. Okay, the okay. Here's the website. www.phoenixcares.ca.
Phoenix Cares, C-A-R-E-S.
Phoenix Cares. P as in Paul, H as in Henry, O as in O, E as in Every, N as in Nixon, I as in Into, X as in Extra, T as in Tomorrow, E as in Ears, A as in Apple, R as in Random, S as in soon. So it's www.phoenixtears, all one word, of course, .ca. I guess that's another thing that kids come into the world now with.
They
believing
understand
that believing that everything is one word. yeah, but I read somewhere that you don't really need to put http://. Actually, even www. Dot is not unnecessary, but although I'm reading something else. No, I don't think you put HTT in front of this.
It all began with people saying you don't really have to wear a tie.
You know, we were ahead of our time. the world of fashion is finally catching up with us and saying you don't have to. I remember Jerry Rubin used to say, wearing a tie is like putting on a noose.
It is.
But then, you know, he started wearing a tie and a suit and he got a haircut and said, short hair is the new long hair. Or the new revolution, maybe. Something. So, what's new?
Well, let's see. New. A couple of weeks ago, I went to funeral for Howard Lotsoff, the guy who discovered the Ibogaine treatment for marijuana addiction.
Oh, I read about that, yeah.
No more fanciful, certainly, than cancer being cured by cannabis oil.
You know, it's all a mystery to me. The older I get, the deeper the mystery gets. So it's just, I just have to, my new mantra is, when in doubt, breathe. And that, otherwise, you know, I start thinking about the infinity of time and space and it gives me a headache.
Well, my answer...
Hemp oil cures that too, by the way. Migraines.
My answer to that question is, what do you believe? Everything.
Well, yeah, I mean, even though I'm a non-believer, I like diversity. I don't want everybody to think as I do.
Right. Well, everybody is, you know, I believe in them. I believe in them. But, you think you might want to read something else from your autobiography?
Oh, sure. Let's see. Do you have any requests? Or should I just look?
Well, it's hard to do because I haven't seen it. I mean, I saw it years ago, but I haven't seen the new edition, the new stuff. You could, you want to talk about the formation of Yippie, or, I don't know, did you write about the sweep-in? Did you write about the be-in, Woodstock, all
well,
of those great moments in countercultural history?
I'll do the first thing you mentioned.
And I'd also like to ask you how... Well, what it was that made you develop into such a skeptic, such a satiric skeptic?
Okay.
I have a theory about it.
Oh, what's your theory?
Well, first tell me what you think it is, and then I'll tell you what I think it is.
I think because the scene I'll read is the opening scene in the book and then show you the connection. So here it is. Okay, should I start?
Sure.
Okay. I first woke up at the age of 6, it began with an itch in my leg, my left leg, but somehow I knew I wasn't supposed to scratch it. Although my eyes were closed, I was standing up. In fact, I was standing on a huge stage, and I was playing the violin. I was in the middle of playing the Vivaldi Concerto in A minor. I was wearing a little Lord Fauntleroy suit, ruffled white silk shirt with puffy sleeves, black velvet short pants with ivory buttons and matching vest, white socks and black patent leather shoes. My hair was platinum blonde and wavy. On this particular Saturday evening, January 14th, 1939, I was in the process of becoming the youngest concert artist in any field ever to perform at Carnegie Hall. But all I knew was that I was being taunted by an itch in my left leg, an itch that had become my adversary. I was tempted to stop playing the violin just for a second and scratch my leg with the bow, yet I was vaguely aware that this would not be appropriate. I had been well trained. I was a true professional. But that itch kept getting fiercer and fiercer. Then suddenly an impulse surfaced from my hidden laboratory of alternative possibilities, and I surrendered to it. Balancing on my left foot, I scratched my left leg with my right foot without missing a note of the Vivaldi concerto.
But wait, what happened then?
Okay. Oh, yes, right on time. Between the impulse and the surrender, there was a choice. I had decided to balance on one foot, and it was that simple act of choosing which triggered the precise moment of my awakening to the mystery of consciousness. This is me. The relief of scratching my leg was overshadowed by a surge of energy throughout my body. I was being engulfed by some kind of spiritual orgasm, by a wave of born-again ecstasy with no ideological context, no doctrine to explain the shock of my own existence, no dogma to function as a metaphor for the mystery. Instead, I woke up to the sound of laughter. I had heard that sound before, sweet and comforting, but never like this. Now I could hear a whole symphony of delight and reassurance, like clarinets and guitars harmonizing with saxophones and drums. It was the audience laughing. I opened my eyes. There were rows upon rows of people sitting out there in the dark, and they were all laughing together. They had understood my plight. It was easier for them to identify with the urge to scratch than with a little freak playing the violin. And I could identify with them identifying with me. I knew that laughter felt good, and I was pleased that it made the audience feel good, but I hadn't intended to make them laugh. I was merely trying to solve a personal dilemma. So the lesson I woke up to, this totally nonverbal internal buzz, would serve as my lifetime filter for perceiving reality and its rules. If you could somehow translate that buzz into words, it would spell out, one person's logic is another person's humor. I finished playing the Vivaldi by rote. Then I bowed to the audience and walked off stage. The applause continued, and I was pushed back on stage by my violin teacher, Misha Goodman, to play an encore, Oriental. I had previously asked him, while rehearsing the encore, why it wasn't listed on the program, since we already knew that I would play it at the concert. But instead of answering my question, he poked me in the chest, verbalizing each poke. Violin up! Violin up! Now, while playing Oriental, I heard the echo of his voice, and I automatically raised my violin higher. Then I popped my ears, and the music sounded clearer. I wondered if it sounded clearer to the audience, too. They had no idea that their laughter had woken me up. I was overwhelmed by the notion that everybody in the audience had their own individual, this is me. But maybe some of them were still asleep and didn't know it. How could you tell who was awake and who was asleep? After all, I hadn't known that I was asleep, and look what I accomplished before I woke up. If it hadn't been for that itch, I might still be asleep. There was, of course, an objective scientific explanation for what happened on the stage of Carnegie Hall. According to a textbook, Physiological Psychology, quote, it is now rather well accepted that itch is a variant of the pain experience and employs the same sensory mechanisms. But to me, something beyond an ordinary itch had occurred that night. It was though I had been zapped by the god of absurdity. I didn't even know there was such a concept as absurdity. I simply experienced an overpowering awareness of something when the audience applauded me for doing what I had learned while I was asleep. But it was only when they laughed that we had really connected, and I imprinted on that sound. I wanted to hear it again. I was hooked. And the first laugh was free. So,
well, that's very nice.
So that moment of awakening for me was I had whatever the sophistication a six-year-old would have, but also the innocence of a newborn. And so I think a lot of people wake up at different times in their lives.
Many go back to sleep.
Many do, yeah. Or they think they're awake and forget that there's many, many more layers of awakening that are possible.
Well, I'll just put it that there was another thing in your life that made you aware of the fact that, as you say, the truth is silly putty.
Right.
Your father was a typesetter, wasn't he?
Yeah.
But a specific kind of typesetter.
Well, he was, do you want me to read that little section to you?
Sure,
that's,
sure.
That's a shorter section, but, it was, but let me just, what I was just saying, was that, that when sometimes people wake up, when they're middle-aged, and they have, a job, and they have a spouse, and they have kids, and suddenly it all seems alien to them. It all seems like, Talking Heads did a song about that feeling. And, so I could see from, what people believed, that truth to them was their reality. Their perception was their reality. I didn't have any of the vocabulary to say anything like that, but I felt it in my guts. Okay, so let's see.
But your father was a typesetter, as I say, he was a specific kind of typesetter.
Well, he said it was.
He set up bogus.
Oh yeah. I see. I'm still looking for that section here. All right. Oh, that's what I'll print to find is find bogus. So thanks for the memory. Okay, let's see. And there it is. Okay. See what I mean? That's magic. I don't understand it. I don't even know how my wristwatch works.
It's those electrons.
Okay, here it is. This was written. This was when I was a kid, and so it was different. Now this was before, let alone photocopying. So you didn't need to set print by hand, but beyond that, it was obviously before digital. All right, here it is. My father had his own print shop. When the local mafia representative came around for protection money, my father, who was a short man, grabbed the unwelcome visitor by his collar with one hand and held a wooden printer's mallet threateningly in his face with the other. I don't know who you work for, he said, but I know you, and if anything happens to this place... Meanwhile, the International Typographical Union ran a campaign to unionize all print shops. My father was strongly pro-union, but he had a Negro assistant, as they were called then. And the ITU wouldn't allow Negroes to become members. My father told the union he was willing to join, but insisted on keeping his assistant. That wasn't acceptable to the ITU. So although the mafia didn't succeed in busting my father's print shop, the union did. Now he worked in the composing room at the Long Island Star Journal, setting up ads. However, national advertisers had developed a system whereby they supplied local newspapers with embossed mats into which hot lead could be poured, and that would save or lose the job of setting it by hand. But the union was strong. They got a reproduction clause, nicknamed Bogus, in their newspaper contract, which fought off this automation by providing that even if a mat were used, the same ad also had to be set by hand. With fine craftsmanship, my father would set up an ad, getting proofs and making corrections. Then when it was finally perfect, it would be destroyed. The lead would be thrown into the hell box, and be melted down for use again. My father compared this to building a sandcastle on the beach, only to see it washed away by the ocean. But it seemed like the ultimate alienation from work. I became so obsessed with trying to decide what I wanted to do with my life that I took a leave of absence from college to figure it out. So it was, you know, and fortunately I ended up doing, it was as if I was destined to do it. You know, because even if you're not mystical, destiny is whatever happens to you. You know, so take it or leave it. Anyway, but that was
Was that when you went to work for Mad Comics?
No, that was in my when I first started. Let's see, when Mad was when I started working for Lyle Stewart at the Independent in 1953, and he was a fan of Mad. It was a comic book then, and I remember he showed it to me, and I just loved the image of Clark Kent going into a phone booth. There's another outdated reference, he going into a cell phone. going into a phone booth and having to wait because Captain Marvel was getting dressed in there, and so he wrote a fan letter to the publisher Bill Gaines at Mad, and Bill Gaines sent him a letter back saying he was a fan of The Independent, which is what Lyle Stewart published, which was the forerunner of the alternative press. And it was an anti-censorship paper, and which is where I got my apprenticeship under him. And Bill Gaines wrote back to him and signed his letter in awe. And so they met and had lunch and became friends, and Lyle became the general manager of EC, which was the parent of not only Mad, but all of the horror comics and... you know, the whole line. And our office had been right near Bryan Park on 6th Avenue and 42nd, but we moved down to what was known as the Mad Building at 225 Lafayette Street in Little Italy. And our office was on the same floor as Mad. And since Lyle was putting out The Independent and working for Mad, I would do errands for both. And so the first time I went into Mad's office, Bill Gaines was chasing his secretary around, trying to stamp "fragile" on her forehead. And I think that was some kind of courting ritual, because later they got married. And but it was kind of a thrill, especially when I had just started doing stand-up comedy, and Bill Gaines invited me to perform for their Christmas party, and that was a thrill. I mean, you know, all these as artists and writers who I had seen reading Mad, I was now entertaining them, and that was.
You what was your stage name then?
Oh well, I was using the violin. I'd stopped playing the violin. I had a technique for playing the violin, but I had a passion for making people laugh. But I used it as a prop, and the name I used then when I started was Paul Mall.
Right.
And people would laugh, and then everything would go downhill. anyway, that was Mad was where I lost my virginity. Bill Gaines gave me a key to his office and the use of his convertible sofa. And it was a very, you know, I was really thrilled because I had gotten my hope to get get a job that fit a definition of happiness that I had learned. It was the only thing I remembered from college, actually. Now, two things I remembered. One was the definition of philosophy was the rationalization of life. And the other was, happiness is having as little separation as possible from your work and your play. And I had found that, and I still to this day feel a certain streak of sadness for people who have to take jobs that they hate or aren't happy with at any rate because they want to be responsible to their families and to themselves. And especially in an economic disaster like the current one, people with who are really prepared and educated for certain kind of jobs have to take the jobs that don't make use of their skills and talents. So it's tragic.
Can I bring up a question?
Robbie Barish is here.
Hi there, Paul.
Hey, Robbie.
Can I bring up a question on the topic you just raised? I know that the current economic times are particularly stressful in California, and there has been very limited coverage here of some student demonstrations that seem to be taking place not only on college campuses of the state university system, but also even at high school level. So my questions are, first of all, what kind of coverage are these things getting out there in the media? And secondly, when you yourself look at these relatively young, to all of us, kids, going through something that maybe we can all relate to having taken place 40 years ago, out on the street picketing, throwing things at people, and otherwise demonstrating against the ills of society, what's your reaction to the current situation with those kids?
Well, the protests were for different things. The free speech movement in Berkeley in 1964 was to have the right to give out pamphlets and things on the campus and to protest the fact that the CIA was recruiting there. And there was protests around the country against the war and for civil rights demonstrations. What's going on now is more, not that those other areas aren't there are demonstrations about it, but what's going on there now is that they're protesting the rise in tuition rates and the budget cutting the staff of teachers. It's really insane priorities. Two of the things that are most important in any civilization, you would think, are health and education.
Being for sale. Yeah. Going to the highest bidder. That's the goal of civilization.
It's like anybody who's seeking a job, you know. You
try and say what you know will please the people who are asking you those questions. So it's a real tragedy what this court has done. You know, I mean, it started with when just saw on TV news today the guy who was the attorney who convinced the Supreme Court that that Bush would be president. And there again, it was one man, one vote. And
boys.
The one man was Justice Scalia.
Yeah, boys.
Yeah, there's no legislative remedy short of a constitutional amendment.
What, that John Roberts lied? Liar, liar, pants on fire. That's the best we can do. Yeah.
Well, the next thing, of course, is going to be the affirmation of the so-called Second Amendment right applying to every jurisdiction in the United States. So,
well, there was a shooting today at the Pentagon, by the way.
I heard about that. It's the guy was just celebrating. He didn't want to hurt anybody.
Well, pretty soon the laws in all the major cities then will be enable all of us to have our firearms.
Right. Well, which is worse, to have a gun in Starbucks or to have a gun in the bar?
To have a gun in Afghanistan. Kucinich has something that he's going to introduce as a resolution that we leave in 30 days from the time the resolution is passed. Sounds good to me.
You said when the resolution is passed, not if it's passed.
Well, I think the country's in favor of ending the little adventure in Afghanistan, don't you?
Misadventure.
Well, you're talking about the people, but what about the people who represent
you're
them?
You're right. I forgot that. You mean the people that...
I mean, that's what the original American Revolution was fought over, was taxation without representation.
Right. Right. So we're going to have some tea parties, but a different kind of tea, maybe.
Oh, yeah, well, that'll be interesting. I guess Sarah Palin will be their court jester.
You betcha.
Did you happen to see her on Jay Leno doing her stand-up comedy?
Yeah, she worked on it, it looked like. Very polished, whole 2 minutes of it.
Well, polished, but soulless.
Yeah.
Well, now she's going to be on a reality TV show.
So, like Goyovich.
She's been courting the people who do Survivor and those other things seriously. So we're going to get to see Sarah from Wasilla and her family on some reality show.
No, it's not going to be that. I would like to see that. I would watch that. But it's going to be like tours of Africa, you know, like a guided tour. And here we have, just pay an extra $25 and you can come on the helicopter and shoot at wolves.
A lot of they Marlon Perkins.
But, you know, she's getting rich, and she owes it all to John McCain's following the advice of his advisors.
Well, it's the American dream, right? Do whatever you can to have both fame and fortune.
Right. So her almost son-in-law, Levi Johnston, you know, what he did to become famous was not use a condom. And there you were with
well, is it absolutely certain that he did not use a condom, or maybe it was a defective condom?
Oh, well, isn't that a new murder series? This is Defective Condom. Meet your buddy for the get in the patrol car.
Cold case.
Yes. Nice. Freezing.
Well, Paul, it's almost 1 o'clock. What do you say, at 1 o'clock we begin to take a few calls from the audience with people who might want to talk to you, ask you a question or two about your autobiography or about your predictions for the next few years, whether you think the governor of New York will resign or whether you think that the governor of California will be impeached.
Or the Brook Violin Concerto.
Right.
Yeah, right. Right. Get my violin out of the closet.
When was the last time you played?
The last time I played was, when my violin teacher died, I think I was like 13 or something like that. I stopped it. I drove him crazy till he died.
How many fiddles did you go through?
But then when I started, how many? Oh, I don't remember. There were little tiny ones.
Yeah, you must have gone through the entire series of sizes.
I don't know if I got to the biggest or not.
By 13, you probably did.
You always, but yeah, there were. I mean, I started off with when I started when I was 3 years old, and I had one that was like the size of a toy violin. And then as I grew up, to clean the strings. But it was. Was that what was the question?
Need a tangent spotter.
I don't know.
Oh yeah, right.
No, I asked you whether you know how many you had gone through in your childhood.
Oh, I know. You asked me the last one I had.
And then whether you went from the tiniest one to full size, did you have like three along the way, or four, or like 10, or
maybe three or four? I don't know. It's a long time. I don't remember.
And you have none now. Is that what you're saying?
No.
I also asked you when the last time you played. I think that was.
Oh yeah, well there was a I was at a dinner party at the home of Tom Laughlin and his wife Dolores Taylor. He played the Billy Jack in that series, and he was a real enthusiast of everything Thomas Jefferson. He had Thomas Jefferson furniture, Thomas Jefferson spoons and plates and forks.
Illegitimate children.
They were serving us. he had recipes. The dinner was recipes of Thomas Jefferson's or of the people who made his meals. The only thing I remember was that we started with peanut soup, and he had Thomas Jefferson's violin, and so it came out in the conversation that I had been this kid prodigy, and so he asked me to play something. And at that point, it had been 40 years since I played the last time, and I just simply had not played. And the only thing I could think of that I felt confident to play was Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. But I was...
Speaking of little stars twinkling in the night, this is WBAI in New York City. KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia, and in half an hour we'll be broadcast on WJFF in Jeffersonville, Grahamsville, and Liberty, New York, and we are streaming on the World Wide Web at WBAI.org.
Without the HTTP.
Without.
But 10 days of antibiotics will fix that.
So I'm going to play a bit of music, Paul, and then we'll take some telephone calls at 212-209-2900.
Y'all can play that guitar. talking rivers on this train. And your best look like a gringo on this train. Hey, your best look like a gringo on this train. Some troopers in El Paso, they'll demand to see your passport if you don't look like a gringo on this train. Kids had all the hot dogs they could eat.
Sue Jeffers, and somebody on the air with us now. Hi, you're on the radio.
Is it me?
Yes, it's you.
Oh, my God. I just tuned in and was amazed to hear Paul Krassner on the air, and I wasn't sure if it was actually he. But I was wondering if Paul could maybe tell us that hilarious story about when he lost his virginity, which I read in his book, Confessions of a Raving Unconfined Nut.
How I lost my virginity. I got it back at the Lost and Found, by the way.
You did?
Yes. I missed it so much.
Mm. I thought the airline lost it with your luggage.
I have no comeback to that.
No.
I'm off duty now.
Oh, come on. Come back.
I believe it had something to do with Mad Magazine.
Now, you know, kids today, they lose their virginity 16, 15, 14, 13, 12, 11. I was 26. This was in the 50s, and the sexual revolution hadn't happened yet. And so finally, when I had a girlfriend, but I had no place to go. I was still living with my parents. At 26, I was editing a very hip magazine, but I was still living with my parents, and I was still a virgin. So anyway, we went. But Bill Gaines at Mad, as I mentioned before, he gave me a key to his office and said I could use the convertible. Sofa. And so, you know, he used to say to, you know, on like a date, do you want to get coffee or something? Then it changed to, do you want to smoke a joint in my place? But between the coffee and the joint, I had access to the office of Mad. And that, boy, that was a real, it's like a guy with a new car or something. It was really a magnet. And they had all of the horror, the old witch, the vault keeper, all of these framed original paintings around the office and of course there was Alfred E. Newman, and so that's where it, and you know there was, it was a time when you somehow had to fake spontaneity, so even though there was a convertible sofa, we ended up on the rug because we didn't want to interrupt the spontaneity of what we had both been thinking about. And so it was just, it was having Alfred E. Newman watch over us the way he had watched over a whole generation of young irreverence, and who felt that, because who had in common a sense of irreverence towards the culture, and you could tell something about a kid who read Mad as opposed to say a Boy's Life magazine, which is all goody goody, and it was appropriate, having the message come to me in my moment of climax. What, me worry?
That was the punchline. You still tell it much better in the book, I guess.
What?
When she asked you, you started to get worried about whether or not you needed a condom or whatever, and she's like...
Right. I didn't set it up where she said...
It's getting more and more heated, and you're all excited, and she's all excited, and right.
And then I said, "We better stop." She said, "It's okay. Don't worry. You don't have to stop. You can bleep me without worrying." And I was shocked by the word bleep. I still am. And it was bizarre. I mean, again, that sense of absurdity that I was a little bit shocked by her saying the word bleep, even though we were in the middle of bleeping. But that was the time. That was the
Paul.
Yes.
I love this guy. He hung up, but he tells your stories so well. You should take him along with you on your next tour.
Oh, right. It's like some people have their own masseur or their own chiropractor, travel around with them, or their own doctor. Yeah, that's right. I have a personal. I know. I have a friend, Julius, who used to hire somebody to remember things for him.
You're on the air.
Oh, good evening. Hi, Bob. Hi, Mr. Krasner.
Hello.
Listen, Glenn Beck is going to be at the Nokia Theater on the 16th of March, which is a Tuesday night. And I know there's a big crowd out there of people who just love Glenn Beck, you know. And he's always busy attacking anybody to the left of Rush Limbaugh. So me and my buddy Joel, you know, Joel Myers. Hello?
Yeah.
How you doing there, Bob? We're going to be out there. We're going to try to muster whoever's not afraid to be seen with us. You know, the more the merrier. Paul, do you have anything to say about Glenn Beck?
Yeah, he makes Bill O'Reilly look sane.
You're
I'm out here on 125th Street. Yeah, there you go. Go. Yeah. You still there?
Yeah, it's very tough to understand it, Gary, because it's tough to understand it because we're getting some feedback.
Yeah, anyway, Glenn Beck, you know, what do you think of Bob? What do you think of Glenn Beck?
I try not to think of him.
Very good, exactly. I hear you loud and clear. Glenn Beck is not somebody we like, and we want to get a number of people. Is it Bob?
Hello?
Did you want to say something? Go ahead. Yeah, we want to get a crowd out there, you know. It's in the middle of Times Square, Broadway area, Nokia Theater. It's a Tuesday night. You know, it's going to be in the evening, 7:30, something like that. And Glenn Benn is always like calling Obama a communist. He's always saying stuff like, you know, Obama must be a member of the Spartacus League or something on the down low, right? So, you know, let's be out there and show our colors, you know, because he's trying to get us all, like, basically put in a concentration camp. He's the new Joe McCarthy, you know. He thinks he's real slick.
All right, thank you, Gary.
Okay, thank you, Bob. You take care. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi, you're on the radio with Paul Krasner. Hello?
Yeah, I control all sound and vision, and what you're doing is totally pointless.
Okay, well, then we won't trouble you to take part in it. You're on the air now. Hello?
Good evening. Hi, Bob. Hello, Mr. Krasner, sir.
Hi.
Just a comment on the last caller. I think you have to have a certain love for Glenn Beck to actually want to stand out in the street and protest him like that. So, I just want to make a comment. I just want to mention a name that I don't think has been mentioned on this radio station all week, and it should be named. The name is, and I'm just curious to see if either one of you gentlemen ever heard of him, Orlando Zabata Tamayo. Have you ever heard of him?
Tamayo?
Yeah.
I think
I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Painter named Tamayo.
Orlando Zabata Tamayo. He is, or was, a Cuban dissident who died on hunger strike in a Cuban jail last week. And he's a man who's a political prisoner. A real one, I would say. And I just find it shocking that there's not one mention on a progressive radio station like this. And I think it deserves to be mentioned, and I think, you know, I'd like to think you agree with me on that, Bob.
What was the essence of his dissidence?
Well, he was arrested in 2003 for being part of a basically, you know, completely nonviolent, by the way, protest movement. And he was on hunger strike then.
What was the protest movement?
I think it was it's called the Women in White, and it was basically just. I think it was just, you know, the freedom to criticize the government out loud. And there's another gentleman, and I can't remember his name, but he's actually just this week has gone on hunger strike, and his big thing was he was demanding freedom for bloggers. So he was demanding internet access without any censorship. He is on hunger strike right now, and it doesn't look too good. He may not survive next week. And
what's his name?
I'm afraid it escapes me, and I'm ashamed to say it is, but I will learn it.
Well, let's hope that he escapes.
Well, he won't escape. and quite sad, really, because, you know, I mean, because I remember as a kid going to Catholic school, you know, predominantly Irish Americans. I remember I knew who Bobby Sands was. All the nuns made us pray for the soul of Bobby Sands. And this guy is really no different than Bobby Sands. But a lot of people, and again, I have to say, it's really a shame. It's a real shame that no one mentioned this man's name once on this radio station.
Well, you did twice.
I'm afraid the station doesn't get any credit for me having the gumption and good fortune to get on your program.
Well, I don't know. You're breaking your arm, slapping yourself on the back there, but.
Well, you put me in that position to slap myself on the back.
But I put you on the air, so you could say something that maybe we had overlooked.
Yes, you did. But anyway,
look, a lot of people have impulses and don't follow them, so you should pat yourself on the back for following the right impulse. I was in Cuba 1 year on the first anniversary of the revolution, and
wow.
it was such a stunning time because the people were so optimistic and so and you could see that they were teaching children the difference between competition and cooperation, and it was so idealistic, and I had asked Castro for an interview, and his secretary was going to call me at the hotel the next day, but that evening President Eisenhower sent a cablegram to Castro breaking off relations with Cuba. So obviously he had better things to do than to give me a Q&A.
Well, I bet in retrospect he's sorry.
Well, yeah, in retrospect, I would have asked him, what do you think of term limits?
Actually, that kind of reminds me, because I know, you know, a lot of people, like, for example, like Kathy Boudin. I think she went a little bit later to, but I think we should remember something, that this Saturday is actually the 40th anniversary of the townhouse explosion. Do you know that?
Oh, boy, how are you going to celebrate that, with firecrackers?
Well, I'm kind of curious. I'm curious just to, you know, go down there, and you can't miss it. It's a very modern building, obviously, because the original one got blown up by them.
Yes, and when they rebuilt it, they rebuilt the wall to look as though it were exploding.
No, get
it. Yes, is that right?
That's right. That's true.
It does jut out. Yeah,
yeah,
that's pure New York.
Mm. So in a way, it's a kind of memorial.
Oh, well, they could have a memorial celebration with Dustin Hoffman as the MC. Didn't he live in that building?
He lived next door.
Next door, right.
And I'll just say this and I'll leave, but it's kind of quite fitting to have a $5 million townhouse as a memorial for a communist revolutionary. Because that's what they were expensive even then. I mean, and Henry Fonda's wife was right down the block, and I think Wilkerson and Boudin, they came running naked out of the building, and she sheltered them, and then they escaped. And
but you know, they weren't. But actually, they weren't making a bomb. They were mixing hemp oil.
Oh really?
And, no, but
hemp oil with nuts and bolts, and I believe a World War One tank shell.
Sounds like you've been waiting a long time.
I work with what you got.
I bet. Well, I guess it's good that they didn't succeed. But again, it's nevertheless, it's a piece of history right there. And I'm glad I spoke with Bob, because I'm sure he remembers those days pretty well.
Take care. Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Hi, you're on the radio.
People.
Hey.
Good morning, Mr. Fast, Mr. Barrett, and Mr. Crowder.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, first thing, Paul, when you said the thing about that little reference, Tom Laughlin and the violin,
uh-huh.
Well, you just, you know, open the gates to all the Billy Jack, entire chapter of my life, the Americana. I mean, I forgot about it completely, you know, and just, on the computer, I see he has a website, it says, and the Afghan, you know, out of Afghanistan now. I mean, it's like, he's as anti, you know, anti-war now as he, with this war as he was with the anti-Vietnam movement. And,
oh yeah, I met him at a Heroes conference in Sun Valley, Idaho, and hung around with him a little bit. And he showed a movie there. I forget the name of it, but it really showed how savvy he was about the political situation in Washington and the,
Billy Jack Goes to Washington, looks like it's called.
Maybe it was that. It was that. And then, so he and I talked about conspiracies we believed in and didn't believe in, but it was really a pleasure meeting him. And because, you know, there was a real dedication to the truth behind, you know, those gung-ho movies.
Okay, well, now, on the issue of violence, I just thought that, I mean, he ends up, you know, using violence to destroy some people who, I, you know, as a 17-year-old boy watching the movies, you know, I could not have hated more, you know, the Bernard character, you know, I mean, they rape, a couple movies, one was against, I guess, the motorcycle, the first movie, before Billy Jack, that one with the oppression of the locals against the hippie school. The other one was a biker gang. Paul, you know better than I do. A biker gang, raping. You know, in other words, the crimes that Billy Jack was getting revenge on, the people he was getting revenge on, really, you really felt they deserved. I'm raising the whole question of pacifism, violence, because this is BAI, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, that's why I said that it was a truth in terms of what you said, that those crimes were so heinous that you... that you felt that rage, when I said gung ho, I meant the violence. You know, that it was like a wrestling match. You just want revenge.
Okay. and
on the character that the other wrestler is playing.
But I'm just saying, it begs the question of this pacifist. I mean, does it not raise these questions of pacifism? I mean, here these guys have raped and killed, and are we supposed as pacifists not? You know, they're just that whole thing.
Billy Jack's reaction to it was one individual's reaction, and other people would have handled it differently.
Okay.
And also yeah,
so,
it was...
and you can identify with what it was that made him want to do that. But
the wife maintained the pacifist stance in spite of, that was... She took the other position. She was the pacifist no matter what. She was not going to kill no matter what you did to her or her loved ones. She was not going to seek violent revenge.
And so that was, fair and balanced.
Right, fair and balanced. Okay, excellent segue, Mr. Krasner, because that's what I'm now going to ask you about. The Tea Party movement, the Fox, the lies of the media. I mean, I guess John Birch Society has been telling their lies for 40 years. What else is new? But I guess now, since Obama's been elected, there's a resurgence, or is it a false... The Mark Potok, the head of the Southern Poverty Law Center, who monitors hate groups, said there are 800. This was on Hugh Hamilton's show earlier in the week. He said there are 892 hate groups in America, up from like 500 or something like that previously. So this year has seen a rise. And that number is a funny number in and of itself, because I would have figured there's just the John Birch Society. I mean, where do you get 892 John Birch Societies from? All right, but the issue of... Well, okay, the teabaggers, they don't want to hear about corporations owning politicians. They want to get rid of big government, but they don't even mention how politicians have been, are nothing but pawns in the game of the corporations that run that Wall Street that owns Washington and Wall Street and insurance companies. I mean,
well, they're beginning to understand that. The people who are in power become the scapegoats, even though it's the mess that was left by the previous administration. But a lot of intelligent people don't know about the secret government and all of the the relationship between corporations and politicians, which is just legalized bribery, So the just anger and rage, some of which is makes sense, some of which is irrational. But it's becoming more and more that they're against Republicans as well as Democrats. So an actual third party could come of it. Even in now they're beginning to say that Harry Reid looks like he's back in the possibility of winning in Nevada because. The Tea Party type voters would take away votes from the Republicans. So
that's always their issue. But Paul, again, not just this past year. Dick Armey, Newt Gingrich, Dick Armey. Hello, we've been doing this for 20 years, right? This past year has been something. Okay, it's something happened exponentially, but Dick Armey is behind this. Okay. Is there any validity to the small government argument? I mean, hello? Is Ron Paul, I understand he has a lot of racist things that don't come out, but there they are, hidden underneath his facade of this intellectual conversation about freedom and liberty. That's the economy. Freedom and liberty. Are you kidding me? How about I say bigger government means more freedom and liberty for me? Right, you guys think it means less freedom and liberty? I think it means more freedom and liberty.
Because of regulations, you mean?
Right. Let's go there. Right. Okay. This battle, the day Glenn Beck opened his mouth after Obama was elected. The first, the past 15 years, Paul, I said I'm a progressive. I'm a progressive. Proud to say I'm a progressive, right? Because obviously we were all not liberals. Ha, bad word from the 60s, right? We were progressives or leftists. First word, first show, first week, Glenn Beck, America, the enemy is the progressives. Okay, so then I see he's fighting this 150-year battle. It's not Glenn Beck. It goes back to the middle of the 19th century, right?
Well, it goes back to killing a bunch of Indians who were here minding their own business, you know.
Well, after the slaughter, the genocide of the Indians, I guess from the issue, I guess industrialization, then came the battle between what, the bosses and the workers. That's what progressivism is, right? Regulations versus no regulations.
And who's behind the regulations, and who do they benefit?
Right, I'm saying the workers. We want regulations so occupational safe and health and safety, minimum wage. Just and then the bosses want you to have none of that. Hello, 18. This is a post-industrial battle, so that's why let's not go back as far as the genocide of the Indians. Let's take it from when it became this post-industrialization, and then that's why Glenn Beck he's saying this is a hunt. You know, he's citing. Woodrow Wilson. I mean, these presidents who I thought of as, the 60s analysis told me these guys were just middle of the road or worse, Democrats or Republicans. To them, they're already extreme. They're already progressives. That's the Woodrow Wilson. I mean, this is this is the history of. Which it may be one of then learn what I hadn't yet learned was what did happen in this country from 1870 on, I guess.
So are you going to be one of those people in that demonstration counter Glenn Beck?
When is that? I when is that, Bob?
It's next Tuesday, I think.
I missed that. Next Tuesday, okay.
Dick
Where?
Dick Army sounds like a redundancy. Mm.
Yes, he did say it would be next Tuesday.
All right, people. Listen, thanks for the time.
Okay.
All right, guys.
Yeah. Do we have another caller there? Why, no, Paul. We don't have another caller. But
good.
We
Nothing
are... But wait. We're just beginning to broadcast... in WJFF in Grahamsville, Liberty, and
Jeffersonville,
New York. That's the station that has a dynamo called Lord Buckley, probably all frozen up now.
Didn't Patrick Henry say that? Give me Liberty or give me Jeffersonville?
Yes, so Grahamsville, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, well... There is another call, Paul. We can take that call when you're on the radio.
Hey, Bobby.
Hi there. Michigan is heard from.
Hello. Can you guys hear me?
Yes, sure.
Hey, hi. How you doing there, Paul?
Okay.
Good to hear you guys. Bobby, this is George out here in Lake Michigan.
Hi there.
What a beautiful... down to hear BAI out in the sky. It's quite nice. It's quite good. I was thinking of several things. It's all pertinent. Remember, Allen Ginsberg and, his poem, Generosity, Generosity, da 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 da, Generosity. You know that? You ever hear that?
No.
Oh, it's awesome. It's on one of his compilations. But
well, what were you?
But we should all be a little bit more generous, like people with like zillions of dollars, like they just walk around on like gold bullion floors and gold bullion ceilings and gold bullion couches and cars and diamond studded the whole thing, If everyone was just more generous,
Ginsburg
we'd have
was generous
for everybody.
Ginsburg was.
Go on.
Say that again.
Ginsburg was generous, you said, Paul.
That's what I was saying.
No, but he was promoting generosity as like a concept, as a consciousness. If everyone just be generous. If you have a lot, you can share, it's more fun. You have more fun if you're more generous. And that everybody would be like at peace, it would be fun. The world could be really fun.
Well,
But, I mean, I was just, it was just one of my musings there. But, you know, Allen Ginsberg inspired it.
And, you know, it was, it came out of his actions. He was quite generous with poets and prose writers and people in the arts and in trying to connect them with publishers and editors, and just trying to share the whatever clout he had.
Well, I was just reminded of something, speaking of Allen Ginsberg's generosity. At his memorial, which was at a Zen house, I guess, on the somewhere in Chelsea, Amiri Baraka was one of the people who was speaking, and he was saying that during the last week of Allen Ginsberg's life, Allen knew he was on the way out, he was terminal, and Amiri Baraka got a call from Allen, and he said, "Amiri, do you need any money?" True.
Yeah, there's a good example. There was another memorial for Ginsberg in Los Angeles, which I emceed, and there was Hunter Thompson was supposed to come. He didn't show up, but Johnny Depp did. Johnny Depp had played Hunter in a movie, which was it? Not
the one from Las Vegas or something.
Yeah, right, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Right.
And then Bill Murray played him in, what was the name of that? Anyway, in another movie about Where the Buffalo Roam.
Right.
And so I had hoped that all three would be there just so I could have, you know, Johnny Depp there and then Hunter Thompson and then Bill Murray, just so I could say, "Will the real Hunter Thompson please fall down?"
Speaking of generosity,
Dutch.
It might be worth mentioning that's going to be another benefit for Thule Kupferberg on Saturday.
Thule, a great hero of the modern
Bowery poets.
That's right.
Great hero.
I'm very thankful to the late David Nolan for playing
the very next day
after the benefit for Thule. Was taking place. David Nolan played it, even though it was an unauthorized recording, as he described it, a ratty-ass recording from the middle of the concert floor. In the audience, actually.
Dave was it, man.
And
Dave was great,
we're
man.
Really,
I know him from the 80s, I know him.
It's just a wonderful thing that he did. I hope everybody comes to the next benefit.
The fracking is still going on. Fracking is still going on. They're crazy people. Why are they destroying my world for money? I have no fracking idea why this is happening. It's so illogical.
Money, greed.
Like, let's destroy, greed. Destroy the world. Oh, good. Right. Let's turn it into sawdust or gold dust or whatever they're turning it into. It's still dust. The dust of the earth. You know, the Indians, you know, my folks, my friends. They go crazy for the dust of the earth, and they couldn't understand it. That's why they lost the battle, because they just could not understand how stupid they were. are we so stupid that we're going to destroy our world for money?
Well,
what is money? Isn't it an agreed psychosis? It's an illusion, right? Wealth? I don't know.
Hi, you're on the radio. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, you're on the radio.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Yeah, this is for Paul Krasner. He seems to be in the know about these things.
Definitely.
What's the status of acid, LSD nowadays? Is it available? Did it drop from the scene completely, or... I'm going to hang up and listen. I just was wondering. I haven't heard about it among the great cacophony of drugs that we have nowadays, but it used to be a useful item at one time, Timothy Leary and all that. I'm just going to hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Well, you know, it still exists, but, you know, the drug use evolves like everything else evolves, and for a while acid had been replaced by ecstasy. Just in terms of use by young people, it's still in use. I think one of the things besides the presence of ecstasy was that there were a couple of big busts. One was one of the biggest manufacturers of LSD, and the other was when Jerry Garcia died, and the Dead Grateful Dead stopped playing for a while, and there were no tailgate parties, and it just was a big part of that market. So it's just a combination of these of these factors, people. A lot of the technology was conceived and experimented with by acid heads, and a lot of the computer programming. And so, you know, even if it's not as big now as it was in the 60s, even acid, which was a vehicle among other vehicles for coming into contact with the unconscious, and even that the spirit of acid lives on its legacy in other generations, benefiting from the insights and the inspiration and the understanding that people got from LSD. So it might have served its time then, and there were other experimental drugs done by chemists and variations in marijuana strains by horticulturists. So it's just a continuing process. And as Robert Anton Wilson wrote, that it was at the timing of in the post atomic bomb, in the atomic age. After the bombs were dropped, that LSD was the hydrogen bomb of psychology, and he wrote that after having gone to Millbrook and to meet with Tim Leary and Rav Das, who was then Richard Alpert. So it's really just there's always been. Just as there's always been counterculture, there's always been different drugs, and that's true in different areas. Opium was big in Asia, but there are plenty of pipe dreamers here in the States.
Yeah, I think he was sort of getting at, Paul, that he was a kind of a catalyst in a way that no other drug really fell into that category. It seemed to inspire art, politics, and you name it.
I think there were other psychedelics, mescaline.
Yeah, psychedelics in general, and
psilocybin.
Yeah, LSD in that sense was the 50s.
And that's still going on. There are still mushrooms. They grow despite the FDA. And despite the DEA.
Right. Prozac seems to have supplanted LSD lately.
Prozac kind of it doesn't give you insight into yourself necessarily. No. It just and Prozac has certain side effects like
impotence,
and depression. Depression is one.
Yeah.
Why do I need to take a pill to feel like this? But also, it can give you suicidal tendencies.
That's right.
So
paradoxically,
you can kill yourself and never be depressed. But it's an age where there's a lot of stress, and people take pills to deal with these things, and it's just a way of that's another way kids growing up think.
this is what people do. They take a mood changer, and it changes your mood. And it's one big experiment and trying to avoid pain. And sometimes it's wanting pleasure, and then that changes to addiction where it's not, you don't do it for pleasure, you do it to avoid pain. And it's caused so much tragic death and destruction. What's going on in Mexico? Mexico is a narco government now, and they're kind of close to our border. And there's things are escalating and coming to a head as if God were the editor in chief and saying, "Okay, get your stories in now. I don't care how bizarre they are. The world is going to end in 2012, and we have to turn into the printer to get the stuff done." So. Get your stories out, and don't worry about how crazy or inhumane it is. It's just a story.
I think you've just encouraged Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who might be listening in about just south of the border.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well.
Well.
He's being investigated by the feds anyway. Finally, you know who he is. You've heard of him?
Oh wait, maybe I'm thinking of somebody.
Joe Arpaio, who. An anti-immigrant stance, he would not be averse to citizen militia groups
policing
the border, right. And he has prisoners wear pink jumpsuits, something like that.
I saw a photo, and it was just so poignant. It showed the wall between Mexico and the United States, and on the Mexican side, there were coffins attached to that side to honor people who had died trying to cross the border.
Wow, sounds like Berlin all over again.
With the ghost of Reagan should come around and say, "Tear down this wall."
Somebody's on the air, I think. Hi, you're on the air.
You know how silly you guys sound? This is almost as bad as the Howard Stern show.
Okay, well, we won't make you put up with it anymore. Hi, you're on the air. Hello?
I was wondering, a few weeks ago, Bob Fass talked about Gleason's Law of Economics, I think, and I was just wondering if he could tell us about why good money is run out of the field by bad money.
Or bad calls.
Excuse me?
Or bad calls.
What are you saying to me?
I'm just rehashing Gresham's Law.
The Monroe Doctrine.
And the Monroe Doctrine.
Well, I don't understand your talking. You thought we were talking economics.
You're off the air. And you're on the air.
Oh, yes. I just wanted to clarify. It's a week and a half from now. It's a Tuesday night, not next week, but the week after, the 16th, at the Nokia Theater in Midtown. By the way, there's a new book called The Harvard Psychedelic Club. Have you guys heard about it?
I think I have, yeah.
Yeah, I started reading it down at St. Mark's, the bookstore. And it's fairly interesting. It talks about how its thesis seems to be that, which might be debatable, I suppose, its thesis seems to be that the counterculture was... Its genesis begins with this Harvard Psychedelic Club with Timothy Leary, Ram Dass, I forget the two other people. What do you think of that thesis?
Well, this is Paul. I'll say something about that. You know, that the counterculture didn't start there. Young people who were experimenting with LSD and with alternative ways of living and trying to have... set of humane values were already in this process, and then these so-called leaders came along, but they were really the followers. Leary admitted that he wanted to learn from kids.
From who?
From young people who were already living the way he then became a cheerleader for this, and those guys were Richard Alpert, who later became Ram Dass, also became a... we used to talk about it, that he was when he would speak somewhere, he was articulating their consciousness. So these guys were... it was an activity of the leaders and the followers, but and they knew it. They knew that they were learning from kids who were already doing it, but they popularized it. But it was already it had already burst out of the blandness and repression of the Nixon Eisenhower years.
Well, the beatniks, right?
The beatniks.
Quote unquote beatniks.
The beatniks preceded them, but the beatniks were really. If you think about beatniks, you think of just those poets and authors and painters of that time. You don't really think of it as a mass movement, except maybe some guys with goatees and berets snapping their fingers in a little jazz joint. But it wasn't a country-wide movement where people began to kind of go to Mecca and go west. And when I interviewed Terry Southern, he talked about it. He said that one of the things that inspired that whole countercultural move was the Freedom Riders,
right,
who went down south to try and get to do registration of new voters. And they were punished for their good deeds. So what Southern said was that that the Freedom Riders showed that you could just go, you know, travel around with nothing but a guitar, and it was a sense of freedom, you know, that people who had disdain for the government still had love for the country, and that was the essence of it. And so I don't accept that premise that these four guys were responsible for the counterculture. They were caught up in the wave of it.
Could the case be made that it was actually facilitated by MK Ultra?
Mm-hmm.
The CIA had hoped to use acid as a means of control.
Ken Kesey took LSD for the first time under government aegis, didn't he?
Right. He in retrospect, he thought he should have asked for veterans' benefits. The CIA, their hope was that LSD would serve as a means of control, but what happened was because, you know, you could, under the influence of LSD, it would be a strong vehicle to deprogram yourself, deprogram somebody, and then reprogram them, which is what Manson did with his so-called family. But in this case, young people all around the country were deprogramming themselves and reprogramming themselves in a more human way of living, and a kinder way, and a more natural way. And so as the war in Vietnam developed, the humane values spread into demonstrating against the war. You would see more and more young people with long hair and beads and tie-dyed shirts and peace signs at demonstrations that had been previously attended by, you know, straight young politico types. And so what this meant was that the CIA's original scenario had backfired.
Unintentional consequences.
Yeah, it boomeranged. And that was because of, you know, there were chemists like Owsley and others who sold a lot, gave a lot away free, and they were, you know, they were, one person's demon is another person's hero, and there were, and people who had studied chemistry now could put their knowledge to good use. So anyway, that was the wave that they were caught up in, and
you're sex, on the air.
Drugs and rock and roll.
He's caught. He's caught up. Well, Paul, we could take a few more calls, but I did promise you that I wouldn't keep you up too much past your normal bedtime.
Well, my abnormal bedtime. Okay. So how about 7 more minutes?
7 more minutes. All right. That's good. Then you're on the air. And you're on the air.
I just got a call back, Bob. Bob.
Okay.
Hello?
Yep.
When I heard Monroe do that Jewish accent, that quasi-Jewish accent, that was unbelievable. You guys,
is that what it was?
No, you guys didn't want to give it any, but he should have been, you know, question like, Monroe, the Jewish accent you do now, do you not think it's offensive? I mean, just that could have been the topic right there, his fake Jewish accent.
Well, he was trying to disguise himself. So
right, he was trying to be disguised, but we also knew it was him. But it revealed a lot about, I mean, that Jewish immigrant, 1890, 1920 experience, broken English, the way they speak. It was a lot was revealed right there, sort of, you know. I'm not giving him credit. Don't get me wrong. I'm not giving him credit.
Okay.
What are you giving him, cash?
Paul, you started by mentioning your violin performances at Carnegie Hall. Didn't you eventually get banned from performing in college, Carnegie Hall? Did you ever talk about that? Something that you had used in one of your stand-ups?
Oh, let's see. What did I get banned?
Right.
I got banned because I think they were afraid that I was going to use rough language.
Guys are real cool, man. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Okay.
You guys are real cool, man, and I feel enlightened by what you're saying. Even some of it is funny, but it's all good, man.
At least
I like you guys.
Oh.
Yeah. No, that's all I wanted to tell you, man. Have a good night, man.
Thank you.
You too. Hey, thanks.
Be careful going home, man. Later.
Take care.
You know, it's like birds chirping in the morning, and they just like responding to each other. He just called to say I like you.
You're on the air.
Yeah, Paul. I was.
Maybe you should.
And you're on the
air. Trying to get to Carnegie Hall again.
This is a lot of dated junk.
And you're on the air.
Yeah. Hi there.
Good morning.
Morning. Yeah, I'd like to ask you a question. And I remember about 15 years ago, I read a science fiction novel, and the first chapter opened up where the United States and most of the world had been converted to Islam. And I look at this religion, and in terms of practice, it strikes me as being rather simplistic, hierarchical, very clear to people who don't have a lot of education.
You, how much of a study of Islam did you do, or is this?
I mean, you know,
is this just a superficial look that you've taken at certain kinds of Islam? Islam is very, very complicated. It's very, very developed. It has many different expressions.
You might
ask Ibrahim Gonzalez, who will be here at
3
o'clock. Well, if if you're going to make Ibrahim angry, I'm certainly, no, I'm certainly not going to entertain your call any longer, especially if it's to attack religion rather than just shrug it off. Are you a practitioner of Islam?
I'm a practitioner of nothing. I was brought up a Catholic. Can I just finish my thesis? As is practiced today by a lot of people, in other words, the revolutionary style, which I think people, you know, it is a complex religion, but I'm talking about this modern manifestation. And I guess what I'm asking is, because I know a number of people from Britain who are over here who are very fearful of what's going on there in terms of, they're thinking of their government being taken over, and a lot of the prelates over there said we won't fire a shot. We're just going to do this from the inside, you know, very quietly, because you're allowing us these freedoms to do that.
Who said this?
It's a number of the English people that I know on you know, that on this side of
they said that this was what the practitioners or the followers of Islam believe.
The contemporary manifestation. I'm familiar.
In other words, it's hearsay twice removed.
Look, everybody can have an opinion.
Basically, Meir Kahani's contention.
Yeah, everybody can have an opinion, and you know what they say about opinions.
Go ahead.
Well, actually, I don't think you can say it on the air. Everybody's got one. It's like another.
Well, I'm not making any assumptions either, and I know what they say about the word assume.
Well, you are. You are. You're saying that.
But I do have a question.
That a particular a violent expression of Islam is characteristic of Islam, and I would say it's not.
Well, for a lot of people it isn't, but for a lot of people it's beginning to be. And it's very attractive to a lot of people.
No offense, but you could say the same thing about Catholics or atheists.
They don't try to blow up buildings or stuff at this point. Not that I know of.
Well,
you know, I mean, let's face it. No, but what I wanted to ask Paul is, you know, What does he think is going to be the trajectory of things in general in terms of what we're going through historically?
I don't know. It feels like...
You wouldn't get a question like that on Howard Stern, right?
Yeah, right.
A second. This is WBAI in New York City, KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia, and WJFF in Grahamsville, Liberty, and Jeffersonville, New York. We're also streaming on the World Wide Web. Go on there. Didn't mean to... silence you. I just had to do a little business.
You want Paul to predict the future, in other words.
Yogi
Berra. Yogi Berra said predictions are very difficult, especially about the future.
I think Paul's future right now involves putting his head down on a pillow. Right, Paul?
Well,
you know, it's impossible to know because there are so many different forces swirling around. It seems to be a crux. Well, a good example is the legalization of marijuana. It seems about to be at a tipping point where it breaks through. A lot of maybe for the right thing for the wrong reason, if it's done in order so that it could be taxed. But at the same time, they busted a guy who was running a dispensary here in California in the middle of last night. It's the devil never sleeps. The devil being the forces of control that hang on. You know, I mean, even the dinosaur wants us to survive. So, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of suffering, and there's going to be a lot of evolving away from that in humanity. But I don't. But maybe when I went nuts from trying to deal with this stuff, and I said to a friend, "When is it all going to end?" And he said, "When is what going to end?" this battle between good and evil.
Yes.
And he said, maybe never. And all of a sudden, a big burden was lifted from me. It meant it wasn't all my responsibility. You know, it might be something that my great-grandchildren would have to deal with. And I understood it when there was... Krishnamurti, who was a guru, but he always insisted he was not a guru.
I'm familiar with him, yes.
Okay, well, he was at Carnegie Hall in New York, speaking before a few thousand non-disciples. Hmm? And there was question and answer, and somebody asked him, why is there evil in the world? And he said, to thicken the plot. And... that became my my filter for seeing what happens in the world as through a theatrical filter, and I could only admire how well people played themselves. You know, there were, in other words, if somebody was as Howard Hearn used to say when he was on landline-type radio, a-holes. That was his abbreviation. But even a-holes can play really good a-holes. And so evil people play evil really wonderful. So, it was a way of seeing... admiring how people play themselves instead of having a resistance to them.
Please remember that
people who are in jail for carrying a certain amount of innocent, innocuous herb.
Look at the same. There's no separation. Tragedy and absurdity are two sides of the same coin, mm-hmm. And so you can be. Aware of that the real aspect of that is to demand amnesty for all those who are in prison for drug offense, nonviolent drug offenses, because they're really political prisoners. It's that. So you can be the trick is to be detached and engaged simultaneously, and so that it's just so you don't take yourself as seriously as your causes.
So the play's the thing, as Shakespeare once said.
Right, but the stakes are high.
But this, yeah. Well, those plays were serious.
Well, yeah, and but they used fake ammunition.
Right.
So the thing is, it, what goes on is dramatic. Does have dramatic conflicts and hysterical stuff where you don't need a laugh track. The thing is, you have to deal with them. You know, even all right. Let me conclude with this. There was a concert in Pittsburgh in about 1967 and the Fugs were playing, and the Velvet Underground and the Grateful Dead, and Jerry Garcia and I had taken some Owsley acid, and we were in the lobby, and he was talking about, we all look alike here in the lobby, and
I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Watch this." He held out his hand, and some of my kid who was at the concert, this was doing a break. Garcia held out his hand and said, "Spare change," and this kid gave him a dime. And Garcia said, "See, we all look alike." But then we started talking about good and evil. And when I mentioned the evil, he said this thing: "There are no evil people; there are only victims." Just as I was peaking, and I kept trying to understand that. Okay, so there's if there's a rapist, you have to kick him in the groin, but with compassion. You know, in other words, they have to be dealt with. You know, they can be victims, but if they're victims and executioners at the same time, they have to be dealt with. And so it's but to bring that full circle, you know, it doesn't matter if they're Jews or Islamics or Scientologists or whatever. And that was the lesson I learned when I had two interviews scheduled. One was with Martin Luther King, but he got assassinated, and the other was with George Lincoln Rockwell, the head of the American Nazi Party. And up to that point, I had been a militant atheist, and I almost judged people on whether they believed or disbelieved as I did. What changed me was that I had this simple epiphany that Martin Luther King was a Christian, and George Lincoln Rockwell was a Nazi, and he considered himself an agnostic. So it just turned me around completely, and it no longer mattered to me what people believed. It was simply how they behaved. And
if somebody said, "By their works shall ye know them."
Yeah, right. That's why I said it's a simple profundity that if people can if. Yeah. It's so it's not even original with me.
No, but you said it for. See, Bob. I mean, I said a few stupid, clumsy things, but I got what I wanted. You know. Thank you, Paul.
Oh, what did you want?
Well, I just wanted you to expostulate on stuff. You know.
You're doing your cleaning up.
That was great. Thanks a lot, Paul.
Okay. Thank you. All right. I'm going to go to bed now. You guys
stay in. People will be very disappointed, Paul. There are still three people who are calling.
Okay, all right.
Figure one of them is somebody that, yeah, you're on the air.
Please grow up.
Okay. And you're
all right,
on the air.
All right, that's good. You know.
Okay, one left.
And you're on the air.
Freedom of speech.
Okay.
And you're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
I had just called early. I like you guys, and this topic was pretty interesting to me about the drug thing. And I just wanted to ask a question because I was watching, like, the History Channel. I read some book pertaining to drugs going back to the ancient times, like the days of Egypt. The Bible, people who read the Bible, that little, what is it, that seal they peel off the paper and put on their tongue, I believe was told, referred to acid. So, like, if society was all bounded up on doing drugs from that point until what, the founding of America subsequently, I gather, I don't know if drugs were outlawed back in the day like that. Were they? I'd hang up and but my question was, if society was founded.
Are you saying that people took LSD in the days of pharaohs,
like in back in the days. I'm not saying that. That was like on the History Channel. They spoke about LSD going back. That even Napoleon used his troops. They used LSD in times of war to make them better soldiers. I read a book whereas they used LSD back in the days of Egypt. For the crazy, what is termed mentally ill. I don't know how true it is, but these are things I've heard on
true.
different.
I think LSD was invented in, was it 1928?
Albert Hoffman on his bicycle.
Well, I'm looking at the nook. I'm just looking at it but from there a were, narcotic standpoint.
There were,
right? Like
there were other psychedelic around. Drugs that were used, you know, ritually.
I wonder if there's ever, like, a record of any abuse, like, of drugs back then. Like in the days of maybe Cleopatra or Jesus. You know, like, was there any drug abuse? I'm more than sure they used drugs back then. It may be a different form, you
lots
know.
Lots of
like
wine in lead goblets.
Or wine, you know. Noah was a drunk, they say. He drank
pewter.
A lot of wine. Or whoever it was. You know? And I'm just thinking, wow, that stuff's gone back. This
well,
stuff goes back a long time. Like, at what point did it become outlawed and, you know, like, totally outlawed? Like, was there a time back then, you know, like in Jesus' time, they did drug raids or something? I don't know, but you guys have me thinking like that. Like, because
well, Paul,
of what I've been
can
watching
you comment on that?
I'm going to hang up, man. Have a great night again, man.
Hey,
all right,
you.
And you guys are the best, bro. Those are
great
job,
questions.
Right? Take care, guys. Keep it up, all right? Later.
Well, you took ayahuasca, Paul. Hello?
Yeah, ayahuasca. I don't know how far back it goes, but I mean, but that was used in healing ceremonies. That,
and mescaline was used ritually.
Yeah, no, these things go back thousands of years. I mean, even stuff was growing before humans. I'm sure maybe the dinosaurs got stunned and they saw these big meteors coming and they said they were just stunned and watched the colors that came down to smash them. You know, it's just, and people... and they had certain ways of getting the ayahuasca, but, you know, you had to get the vine. The ayahuasca meant soul vine. And you had to cook it in a certain way and boil it. It was very rituals handed down from generation to generation. And there's just a book out, coming out soon about ayahuasca. It's, you know, the research is still continuing. So I think drugs have always been a part of, and a lot of times by elitists. Ecstasy was being used in some of the inner circles before it got to more to the general population. So, you know, it's always, I don't know, it was a good question too about when, the drugs were declared illegal. Usually when the government found out that, people were having pleasure, that's always a stopper.
Yeah.
All right, you can have medical marijuana as long as it doesn't get you high.
Yeah, I said that the hippies kind of ruined medical marijuana because they told people that it was fun.
Yeah, but the corollary to that is that all marijuana is medical.
True.
If only because it helps relieve stress and so much disease is caused by stress, or at least exacerbated by stress.
I think they will be over-diagnosing glaucoma, though, in the future.
Oh, yeah, 13-year-olds. I have glaucoma. But, you know, again, more and more people are becoming aware of it. More and more doctors are referring people to it. And I went to it might be unique, but last weekend I went to medical marijuana farmers market, where they had all kinds of different strains for different things. This is will relieve pain and kind of put you to sleep with. This will stop your feeling of nausea, but
but not interfere with your creative powers. I mean, there are really, it was like a scene, it was a timeless scene of people experimenting with nature to help people feel better. You know, it was an inspiring little tour that we got of this place. And it was like any farmer's market that you see, except that it was indoors, and they had people, and they had security. But it was very pleasant that everybody that I interviewed there was, they felt so optimistic, and that they had, that they were doing work where they could exercise their sense of compassion. And you could see the patients come in there to figure out which was would be the best strain for them. So it was like living in the past and the future simultaneously.
How does that compare with the experience of going into a coffee house in Amsterdam and being allowed to pick your pharmaceutical?
The feeling was the same. The feeling was one of freedom and hope. Although here, in Amsterdam, something happened that I don't think would happen here, not yet, which was a woman bought some pot in the coffee shop and rolled a joint, and then she was going outside to smoke it, and she realized that she didn't have matches or anything. So there was a policeman there, and she asked him if he would light it, and he did.
Mm-hmm.
So
Sergeant Sunshine all over again.
Yeah, you know, it was so. It was a nice symbol of even as a organization called LEAP, which is let's see, I forget what it's an acronym for, but it's current law enforcement and retired ones who are for the end to end prohibition. I mean, they know. Even when they bus people, that it's wrong to do that, but you know, so it's. Lenny Bruce said that in 10 years, he said this in 1960, that it would be legal, because all these law students were going to go enter politics. But once again, the devil never slept between racism and greed, and. Statism, they've held back the laws, even though both Nixon and George Bush had commissioned to look into the decriminalization of marijuana. And both of these studies that they commissioned said, yes, it was doing more harm than good to have prohibition. And so both of those studies, those reports, were buried and the advice never followed. So, you know, it's this country was founded by Puritans and pioneers, and the Puritan streak and the pioneer streak are still vying for the Olympics of progress. And so now I'm going to go.
That was a great statement, Paul.
Yeah, well, I'm going to go grow up now.
Grow? Anyway.
All right. Thank you, guys. I love you, Bob. It's
Thank
always
you. Love
a pleasure.
You, Paul. Same here.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Good night, Paul.
Good night.
He held was hot and he, however, stayed as I started on my journey. needed a shine. But oh, Coca-Cola is fine, boys. Coca-Cola is fine. We've got to protect all our citizens fair. We'll send a battalion for anyone there. Maybe we'll leave in a couple of years. As we're the cops of the world, boys. We're the cops of the world. Dumpster vents in a pile, boys. Dumpster vents in a pile. You better wipe off that smile, boys. Better wipe off that smile. We'll spit through the streets of the cities we rent. Find you a leader, you can't elect.
Was a little way, said stay away.
Well, the girl I love, baby, she tell me. Hey, Lord, goodbye. Hey, Lord, hey, God, all night long. Hey, it's all, hey, it's all, hey, it's all night long. Baby, take your time. Hey, it's all night long. Baby, take your time. Have it all night long. Have it all night long. Honey, take your time. Got the blues, got the blues. Can't be satisfied. Can't be satisfied. Got the blues, got the blues. Can't be satisfied. Come out, come out. Down on my knees. Down on my knees. Come here, come here, y'all, but I'm on my knees. Oh, hey, hey, no, 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 that's all night long. Goodbye, goodbye. Goodbye to you, goodbye to you. Goodbye, goodbye, oh Lord, it's all night long.
Rolando, you know you should never swat a fly, because he may have another fly, and he may sit with her, and he may sigh, just the way I do with you. That's right. And you know you should never ever harm a flea. Because he may have a favorite she, a little flea she, that he bouncy, wouncy, wounces on his little flea knee, just the way I do with you, Rolando. And you know you should never harm a bee if he is going anywhere. Because you know, you could be concluding, you could be ending, you could be busting up some terrific insect family love affair. Be careful. Now look, don't you slug a bug, or approach a roach, or stick a tick, or torpedo a mosquito, or bug a slug in the middle of a rug, because, you know, all these hairy little insects may want to share a hug, just the way that I do with you. Yeah. Swat a fly, he may have another fly. He may sit with her and sigh the way I do with you. Never harm a flea, he may have a favorite she that he bounces on his knee the way I do with you. Never harm a bee if he is going anywhere. He may be concluding some bug family love affair. Be careful, don't you snug a bug in the middle of a rug. He may want to share a hug the way I do with you. La 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 la.
Never, never, baby, can see anymore. Run your baby. how long, I ain't had no loving since my baby gone.
Get together with one another, iron out of problems and iron out of troubles, and try to live as brothers. Try to find peace of mind without stepping on one another. And do respect all the women of the world. Just remember that you all had mothers. We got to make this land a better land than the world in which we live. Help each man be a better man with the kindness that we give. I know we can make it. I know that we can. I know darn well we can work it out. Yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can. Why can't we if we want to? Yes, we can. I know we can make it. I know that we can. I know darn well we can work it out. Yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can. Why can't we if we want to? Yes, we can. Children, the little children of the world, 'cause they're our strongest hope for the future, all the little bitty boys and girls. We got to make this land a better land than the world in which we live. We gotta help each man be a better man with the kindness that we give. I know we can make it. I know darn well we can work it out.
Yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can. Why can't we if we want to? Yes, we can.
Well, I know we can make it. And I know darn well we can work it out.
Yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can. Why can't we if we want to? Yes, we can. We just got to make it, y'all.
Take care of our mothers. I'm talking about Mother Earth. Clean up all the pollution, y'all. Let's get together now and get to work. I know we can make it. I know that we can. I know darn well we can work it out.
Yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can. Why can't we if we want to? Yes, we can.
I know we can make it. I know that we can. I know darn well we can work it out.
Yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can. Why can't we if we want to? Yes, we can.
Get together now.
Get together
now. We got to make this land a better land than the world in which we live. Help each man be a better man with the kindness that we give. I know we can make it. I know that we can. I know darn well we can work it out.
Yes, we can. Oh, we can. Yes, we can.
Why can't we if we want to? Yes, we can. I know we can make it. I know that we can. I know darn well we can work it out.
Yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can.
Why can't we if we want to? Yes, we can. I know we can make it. Come on, let's just make it, y'all. I know we can make it. We got to help each other make it, y'all. I know that we can.
know we can make it.
I know we can make it.
I know damn well we can work it out.
Come on. Yes, we can. I know we can. Yes, we can.
Why can't we if we want it?
Yes, we can.
I know we can. I know we can. I know we can. I know we can. I know we can. I know we can.
Si se puede.
The king's guardsman's greedy. He's underpaid, he knows. Taylor sew me a cloak of indigo that will disguise me well for the highwayman's game. No one will suspect evil, and the king's cross are the same. Will pay you dearly with half of what I claim. No, said the tailor. The tailor said no. A cloak will not hide what your own eyes see. Cloak will not change what is hidden underneath. Just as mine does not confine the idea of what I am. I am not a tailor, I'm a man. The king's queen is hung with the pleasures adultery knows. Taylor sew me a cloak of scarlet that will disguise me well for courting on the sly. That will make the fever transparent to the night's eyes. I will pay you dearly with favors and with sighs. No, said the tailor. The tailor said no. Will not hide what your own eyes see. A cloak will not change what is hidden underneath. Just as mine does not confine the idea of what I am. I am not a tailor, I'm a man. He is frightened with shadows behind his back. Taylor sew me a cloak of sable that will disguise me well from the daggers of my foes. That will keep me far above those that are below. I will pay you dearly if you fail on the gallows. No, said the tailor. The tailor said no. Cloak will not hide what your own eyes see. A cloak will not change what is hidden underneath.
just as mine does not confine the idea of what I am. I am not a tailor, I'm a man.
It was starting to get cold. He stopped talking about a home. Somewhere in the night when he left the world alone. Next morning, the city crew took in another John Doe.
City and KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, and WJFF in Jeffersonville, Grahamsville, and Liberty, and WJSR in Nelson, British Columbia. We're going to be here for another 25 minutes or so until Ibrahim Gonzalez or Ahmed Ali comes in, and I hope.
Teleppa silako juunsa, katopien maalla sidattu tevellä kuuma. Ei ole voijalo, korella kuunso, kuotitaan näistä toisaalta saada. Se piosa tai moi kai soksa siinä. Ei ulte voikee, poput saare toikee, se peko, ei suilo peko. Tarvat vapuuna, tavannu kaanjaa, vaan lakrut pohkuuna uusta kraanja. Ei che tu i te cari sopra di te c'è maletta di chi non sporetto. Oh, ma tu stanchi ti cati ne mosi gatti. Alla braccia, na me otto pazza, mi si braccia, da ne ma no vaccia. E ma pista ne ma nisce, pa ne ma ni luce, da mette na clavu, na tu ne agu. Bristu, šupat, ja ću onu uzat, hoćemo je na salaš, pa pomalo svaki dan i na tavan.
Thank you. pour on me, pour on me, pour little on me wine. How she was deluded by John Lewis's lies. He promised to meet her at Adams in spring. He'd bring her some money, some other fine thing. Her a fool like she met him at Adams in spring. He brought her no money, no other fine thing. He brought her no money, but he flattered the king. We'll go and get married, it'll be no disgrace. She jumped up behind him, and the way they did go, till he come to the river where deep water flows. John Lewis-y, won't you tell me your mind? My mind is to drown you and leave you behind. Take pity on my infant and spare me my life, and let me live single if I can't be your wife. He kicked her and he choked her and he turned her around. Then he threw her in deep water, where he knew she would drown.
Pharaoh's bill ought to be killed. Never working, he never will. I'm a ride my railroad bill. Railroad bill done took my wife, threatened on me that he would take my life. Now I'm going to ride my railroad bill. Gone upon the mountain, take my stand, part of one danger in my right and left hand. Now I'm going to ride my railroad bill. Gone upon the mountain, going out west, 41 done, you're sticking in my breath. Now I'm going to ride my railroad bill. Buy me a gun, just load my arm, kill nobody ever done me wrong. Now I'm going to ride my railroad bill. Buy me a gun with a shiny belt, kill somebody by my good-looking gal. Now I'm going to ride my railroad bill. Got a 38 special on a 44 frame. How the world can I miss him when I've got that aim? Now I'm going to ride my railroad bill. Then I went to the doctor, asked him what the matter could be. If you don't stop drinking, son, it'll kill you dead. Now I'm going to ride my railroad bill. Gonna drink my liquor, drink it in the wind. Doctor said he'd kill me, but he never said when. Now I'm going to ride my railroad bill. If the river was brandy and I was a dove, I'd sink to the bottom and I'd never come up. Now I'm going to ride my railroad bill. I never wanted to think of me, just because I'm living on pork and beans. Now I'm going to ride my railroad bill. Then you talk about your honey, you ought to see mine. She's humpback, bow-legged, crippled, blind. I'm a ride, Marie Roadville. Honey, honey, do you think I'm a fool? Think I'm gonna quit you while the weather is cool? I'm a ride, Marie Roadville. Honey, honey, what do you mean? Born to the world in my heart to feel. I'm a ride, Marie Roadville. Fire of mountain, grave of saints, pull to the world in the night of wind. I'm a ride, Marie Roadville.
The sun was shining, I was laying in bed, wondering if she'd changed it all, if her hair was still red. Her folks, they said our lives together sure was gonna be rough. They never did like mama's homemade dress, papa's bank book wasn't big enough. And I was standing on the side of the road, rain falling on my shoes, heading out for the East Coast. Lord knows I paid some dues getting through, tangled up in blue. She was married when we first met, soon to be divorced. I helped her out of a jam, I guess, but I used a little too much force. We drove that car as far as we could, abandoned it out west. Split up on the docks at night for the green it was bad. Turned around to look at me as I was walking away. I heard her say over my shoulder, we'll meet again someday on the avenue, tangled up in blue. I had a job in the great north woods, working as a cook for a spell, but I never did like it all. And one day the axe just fell. So I drifted down to New Orleans, where I lucky with a bee employed, working for a while on a fishing boat right outside of Delacroix. But all the while I was alone, the past was close behind. I've seen a lot of women, but she never escaped my mind. And I just place and I stopped in for a beer. I just kept looking at the side of her face in the spotlight so clear. Later on when the crowd thinned out, I was just about to do the same. She was standing there in back of my chair. I said, Timmy, don't I know your name? I murdered something underneath my breath. She studied the lines of my face. I must admit, felt a little uneasy when she bent down to tie the laces of my shoes. I knew how to
They sat together in the park as the evening sky grew dark. She looked at him and he felt a spark tingle to his bones. 'Twas then he felt alone and wished that he'd gone straight and watched out for a simple twist of fate. They walked along by the old canal, a little confused, I remember well. Then stopped into a strange hotel with a neon burning bright. He felt the heat of the night hit him like a freight train moving with a simple twist of fate. A saxophone someplace far off played as she was walking on by the arcade. As the light busts through a beat-up shade where he was waking up, she dropped a coin into the cup above a blind man at the gate and forgot about a simple twist of fate. Was bare. He didn't see her anywhere. He told himself he didn't care. Pushed the window open wide. Felt that emptiness inside to which he just could not relate. Brought on by a simple twist of fate. He hears the ticking of the clock. Walks along with a parrot that talks. Hunts her down by the waterfront docks where the sailors all come in. Maybe she'll pick him out again. How long must he wait? One more time for a simple twist of fate. People tell me it's a sin to know and feel too much within. I still believe she was my twin, but I lost the ring. She was born in spring, but I was born too late. Blame it on this simple twist of fate.